This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When you look at what's happening to the world right now, there's a tremendous inertia that is so destructive. And so it takes time for people to realize it, to wake up, then to begin to act and to find those levers and tools and understandings that actually inform and make it more powerful. And so there's this lag time. This lag time is so painful. It is so painful to see the lag time in climate change.
Today on Sea Change Radio, we begin our two-part discussion with Paul Hawken, thought leader, author, and environmentalist, perhaps best known as the co-founder of the gardening supply chain Smith & Hawken. This week, listeners will learn about Hawken's path from civil rights activist to environmental champion to gardening guru, and hear his thoughts on what it will take to make real social change. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author, environmental activist, and businessman, Paul Hawken. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex.
You've had such a very interesting and varied career. Maybe you can walk us back to being raised in the Bay Area. How did you get involved in the civil rights movement? And was it more from like an anti-war sensibility, or is it more environment, or just anti-establishment in general?
Well, I was born here in San Mateo, and I'm fifth generation. So yesterday I was at the Sheraton Palace Hotel in New Montgomery and Market Street, and it's actually where my great-great-grandfather had a bookstore right after the beginning of the Gold Rush, specializing in books on Catholicism in German and French. And I joke that that's the beginning of a long history of small business failure in my family, but he was redeveloped and then went down to the valley and started a farm, which he was originally a farmer. And I grew up in Berkeley, which really was very formative. My father worked at the university, and so I went there every day after school and hung out in the library. I used to go in the stacks and, you know, the ninth floor of the stacks, and then sit down on an aisle and start pulling out books by the spine and reading. And so I had this sort of odd way of seeing the world because I was surrounded by professors, obviously, but also artists and musicians and people drinking wine when I was a kid, you know, and talking their little heads off about the world, really. And so I learned a lot from that, or took in a lot, put it that way. So for me, like going into, for example, the civil rights movement was sort of just like stepping off a bus or on a bus, whichever way you want to look at it. But it was an easy transition. It made sense. And my father was a photographer, and one of my earliest memories is a dark room. So I just picked up my camera and went south, and I thought, hey, I can take photographs. And so I went to Selma originally for the March on Montgomery, and it was just a big mobilization. I went there before the march, so I went there several weeks before, and by default became the press coordinator for the March on Montgomery. And the reason you registered press then is because they could disappear. And then I came back at that summer, and I was a photographer for the Congress of Racial Equality, stationed in New Orleans, but going out into Bogalusa and Plaquemine Parish in Louisiana and Meridian, Mississippi, where Schwerner and Cheney and Goodman, the three civil rights workers, had been tortured and then killed by the Ku Klux Klan and buried in a levee.
So it was more stimulated by social justice originally, and then it kind of bled into environmental activism?
Well, it started there. And I mean, well, I went to Meridian to photograph the Klan, because they had received an order from the Department of Justice that they could no longer march with hoods.
And this was when you were in college?
I was 17. I wasn't even
in college.
No. And 18, I think it was 18. And it was the first time that they'd ever marched without their hoods on. In other words, they had to show their faces. And so there I was, this naive, you know, little white boy in Meridian, Mississippi with my Pentax, you know, camera taking pictures of the Klan. And that didn't go well. It's like I remember looking through the lens. And
easier than if you weren't a white boy.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I mean, you learned a lot about, and I say this with compassion, about hate, really, but you see a lot, you saw a lot of hate, real, real on fire hate. And it didn't make sense, but it did make sense in a funny way because it was there and it was deep and historic. And so when I, to this day, hear about Shia on Sunni violence or vice versa in the Middle East or, you know, conflicts all over the world that go back, they go back centuries. It's just crazy how the human species will take on conflicts in the past, all because they believe that they exist.
And not learn from those mistakes. I've seen pictures of these Klansmen or the segregationists from the early 60s in Alabama and pictures of them and saying, these people, this might be your grandfather.
Yeah.
And 50 years from now or 40 years from now, we might look back at these people who are protesting against marriage equality and look back at them with the same, almost just shaking our heads. Like, how can we understand that kind of disconnect in the human psyche?
And it all goes down to the same thing, because we're no different than them in the sense that if we believe what we think, you know, then we have an attitude and we think we're right. And therefore, somebody else is wrong. And so it was actually very, very effective teaching for me. It wasn't that I didn't think that there wasn't justice, you know, in what we were trying to express, but I did get a fuller, richer sense of the human dilemma, you know, which is really all, again, in our mind and how we think, you know, it's what we do is what we think, how we see the world. And so for me, it was really an opening, even though I was scared shitless, to be honest. I mean, it was just the most terrifying time I ever had in my life. And I remember when I went into Kosovo with the UN KFOR's troops, you know, as a journalist to report on the conflict there, just with when the UN troops went in, I mean, you know, and there was landmines everywhere, you know, and you had to be really careful where you walked. You couldn't go off the roads. And people said, were you scared? And I thought about it, you know, I wasn't, you know, I thought, no. So why weren't you scared? I thought, well, that's a good question. I mean, I didn't feel fear. And I thought about it, I thought, oh, I know why I'm not fearful. Because of Mississippi, that was fearful. I mean, during that time, that was crazy, crazy. You were a white kid, didn't matter where you're from, but the north, the east, the west, and you were a civil rights worker. People, the whites in Mississippi, could spot you a block away. A block away. They knew you weren't from Mississippi. They knew why you were there. They could see you. And boy, the only place you were safe was in African-American communities. That's the only place you were safe.
You also wrote about how Rachel Carson's Silent Spring made an impact not only on you, but on a generation maybe your generation of environmentalists. You were talking about some of the photographers. Maybe you could expand on what Carson's writing meant and how it was a springboard for action.
Well, actually, the springboard was that my father was an early member, well, not early because it goes way back, but I mean, he was a member of the Sierra Club. And so at that time, Sierra Club was more like, you know, Tyrolean hats and lederhosen and Bota bags, and you go rock climbing, you know, with people. But at the same time, when I was 10, 11, I met David Brower.
And can you give our listeners a little background on who David Brower is?
David Brower was the person who took over the Sierra Club and really transformed it from what was basically a weekend excursion
Audubon
group,
Society.
You know, yeah. Well, he was the one who transformed it into a very activist organization with 2 million members today. I mean, that wasn't how many he had then. He published a series of amazing books, you know, about the environment. He was the one who led the campaign to stop the damming of Grand Canyon by BLM. And so David Brower is probably the most famous environmentalist in American history other than John Muir. He was just an extraordinary man, and he became a mentor, not at that time, but later in my life, and just a dear friend, as he was to many people. So I had these influences, which you're not so aware of as when you're young, because it's like you're a fish, you're in a water, you don't think what water is, but that was my water, was people who really cared a lot about being outside and cleaning up after themselves and taking care and any incursion or damage to what was wild or what was natural was seen as an insult, as, you know, basically out of integrity. So coming back from the civil rights movement, it just made sense, and everything made sense in terms of the growing environmental movement that started really, not, it didn't start with Rachel Carson at all, but she definitely was the woman who brought it to the fore, and it's never stopped since the publication of Silent Spring. There's no question about that. For me, it was an easy step. It wasn't like one versus the other. And I think because of that too, because like when I was in Bogalusa, I mean, all the whole African-American community was downwind from the Crown Zellerbach plant. And downwind, I mean, you could smell it, taste it, breathe it, see it on everything, the pollution from the plant. And the asthma and the sicknesses and the disease and the discomfort that, you know, was pervasive in that community was directly due to what was upwind.
So sounds like Richmond.
It's exactly like Richmond. And so I never had that idea that somehow, well, there's social justice and then there's the environment and they ought to talk to each other, you know. I mean, that did happen in the movement, no question. The environmental movement became a sort of an upper middle class white movement. It started that way in this country way back, you know, in the early 19th century. It started as an upper class white movement to save, you know, hunting places and places where fish were. And I mean, it started by the rich.
Well, you can also understand how a 17, 18-year-old, he's coalescing. So obviously his ideas may be inchoate in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And then finally, when I was 20, I changed my diet. I had asthma all my life. And I read a book that said, if you're sick, it's your fault, which I pissed me off, but I realized that there was truth in it. The truth is the power that you could change it. And I had been going to doctors and taking pharmaceuticals since I was a wee child. And I got rid of my asthma in 10 days, and it kind of shocked me. And by eating a very austere vegetarian diet, and then I kept going back out into a larger diet, the kind of diet I had before, the foods I ate, which was pretty trashy when I look at it right now, but I mean, and going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and then really convincing myself that, wow, food had a profound impact on human health. It seems so obvious now, but in the, you know, in the late 60s, I mean, it was really maybe the 50s too, but the low point in American nutrition, diet, supermarkets. I mean, it was just, everything was trash. And so that then connected me to farming, to agriculture, to biological agriculture, so-called organic agriculture. And what was in our food? Where did it come from? And who made it? And where were the conditions under which it was grown in terms of water, soil, pesticides, herbicides? And so my grandfather was a farmer, and he was an organic farmer by default, but I learned a lot about what was going on in agriculture in the United States at that time. And that also, to me, was an environmental issue.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealer's horn. Just thank the Lord.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and environmental activist Paul Hawken. Looking at your career on paper, it could look in a vacuum that, well, he was an environmental activist and then he decided to cash in and make money. But hearing the natural progression, it wasn't like you, first of all, started a steel company. You started a natural foods wholesaler, Air One Trading Company, which was a offshoot of your interest in health food in general.
You know what it really was, Alex? I thought, well, gosh, man, I just figured this out. I'm slow. I figured out that, wow, I could cure a chronic disease quickly in this case, but eating just simple, pure foods. And I thought, boy, if I can figure it out, other people are going to figure it out. And at that time, living in the Bay Area, to go buy our groceries, you had to go to Chinatown, to Japantown, you had to go down to Mission, you had to go to Lebanese stores, you had to go to Oakland, to the food mill, to the Seventh-day Adventist, you know, store that made fresh peanut butter and ground flour fresh. You had to go all over the place in the farmer's market to actually get everything you needed for just good, clean, pure food. And I just thought, wow, if somebody put this under one roof, it'd be really helpful. And that's how everyone started, really. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go into business. And actually, at that time, I thought, well, I could do it as a nonprofit. I could do it as a co-op because we were members of the Berkeley Co-op. Or I could do it as a for-profit. And frankly, the only reason it was a for-profit was because it was so difficult to do the other two. It's just logistically difficult. It's much easier to do a for-profit. And so it started as a for-profit. I never made a cent from it, by the way, but except my wages. So that's how I started Air One Trading Company.
But then it sounds like you got even more involved in the ingredients that went into these finished products with Smith & Hawken gardening stores. Maybe you can explain how those stores kind of
how they morphed.
Took off.
Well, Air One, by the time I left, we had over 30,000 acres under contract. And most of that was under contract to farmers who had not grown organically or had and didn't really realize it, by the way, like dryland wheat farmers and the panhandle. And most of that larger acreage, by the way, was dryland crops that take a lot of acreage and very low yield, so it's not as much food as it may sound, but 37 farms, and I don't know, 55 farms in 30 different states. So it created this pool of suppliers, of growers, and learned an awful lot about what was going on, again, in terms of agriculture, why farmers shifted away from default organic agriculture to industrial agriculture after the war and the pressures and the influences that played upon them economically and otherwise in order to conform to this new type of growing, this new way of growing food, which was toxic both to them, to their workers, to the environment, to birds, to everything else. But Smith & Hawken actually arose because I was on the board of directors of Ecology Action, which is a nonprofit in Palo Alto, which taught biodynamic French intensive gardening to people in the developing world in order to increase their nutrition because they particularly lacked vitamin A, which is from, you know, green vegetables. And so John Jevons had started that, and he imported these tools, these really strong, great forks and spades from England, because you really needed that to double dig. There was no other way, really, at that time. And the supplier in Ohio had a flood, and the tools all floated around, and then the water went away on the Ohio River, and they sold the tools, and they all rusty, and they just broke. And the supplier went out of business, so I said, I'll just loan some money. We'll just import them directly, because I had been importing food from Erewhon, from Japan, and from Europe. So I thought, I know how to import. There's no problem. And then we had a container on the water, and John Jevons decided that he did not want to do it through the nonprofit. And it was my money in that container on the water of tools from England. And that's when I started Smith & Hawken, because it was my money. But it was never intended to be a for-profit company.
But you say
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and environmental activist and businessman, Paul Hawken. In 1993, you wrote The Ecology of Commerce, over 20 years ago, and I read this quote that you had pulled out from John Kenneth Galbraith. The expurgated quote is, "The modern conservative is engaged in the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness." Reflecting on 20 years from now, can we overcome that instinct towards selfishness? That instinct of, well, I earn this, so I get to use it however I see fit.
I don't think we'll ever overcome that instinct. I think what we can change is the definition of self.
Into?
Well, you're myself. I mean, when we understand the self is just a complete figment of the imagination, it doesn't exist, then our selfishness actually becomes a way to improve the lives of all living beings around us, because they're our self as well. It really has to be experiential. You have to have that breakthrough, that understanding that, you know, that wow, whoa. You cannot teach that. You can talk about it until the cows come home, but unless you actually have that experience, then it's a concept. You can act based upon the concept, and that is a very, very good thing to do. But when you have that moment, and it only takes a moment, it only takes a second to see that and to experience that, then you still have to take care of yourself in the sense of, you know, if you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of anything else. But taking care of yourself is very, very different than accumulation. It's very, very different than taking care of yourself at the expense of others. It's very different in terms of taking that which doesn't belong to you. It's very different than not knowing the impact, the implication of what you buy, what you invest in, what you drive, how you, you know, function in the world, you know. And if you basically shudder, constrain, put blinders on yourself, then you can cruise through the world and do great harm without knowing it. But once you take those off, you can't do it, because it's you.
You talk about being humble, like we need to learn to be humble. Do you think that's part of that?
I don't know if I ever said that. That's such a proud statement, learning to be humble.
Well, I think you said it more disparagingly towards the corporatization of our and income inequality issues back, you know, 20 years ago. You were saying, until we can kind of become more humble, then we're not going to progress as people.
I struggle with every day. Humility is something that is cultured, you know, within us. You know, it's grown. I don't know. I don't think I'm humble enough to understand what humility is.
Well, let me go back even farther. So in The Ecology of Commerce, you write how after the Civil War, talking about your grandfather and post-Gold Rush, after the Civil War, this country was a mess. We had the transference of great wealth to corporations, right, rampant child labor, and we now had these corporations with this almost corporate personhood,
yeah, based
very much on this due process clause of the 14th Amendment.
Right.
It sounds very eerily similar to now. And you were saying 20 years ago that you wrote about the 1% and the 99% and these income equality issues. So can people change as a whole? Because that seems like that's what we need to do to really make an impact on our environment ultimately.
Absolutely, people can change. Groups of people can change. They change when one person changes. It's like, it's a complete paradoxical statement. One person changes and other people change.
Does it have to be a quote unquote leader? What do you mean when you say one person changes?
It can be a leader, but leaders can't lead unless people have changed as well. So do transformed people create leaders, or do leaders create transformed people? It's, again, it's chicken and egg. It's yin and yang. You really can't say where it begins and where it ends and where it starts. I worked with Martin Luther King. He was a leader, for sure. But if you look at the history of the Montgomery bus boycott, there were some extraordinary people in Montgomery that preceded him. Actually, they're the ones who brought him over from Atlanta to Montgomery. Rosa Parks was educated before she didn't give up her seat to the white man on that bus in Tennessee. And she was educated in nonviolent resistance. So a leader can arise, like an extraordinary man like Martin Luther King, but when you really look at the history, there was this tremendous amount of ferment and action and bravery and courage that preceded it by people whose names we don't know and people who gave up their lives. One of the men who was thrown off the bus before Rosa Parks was killed. He was a soldier, came back from the war. We don't know his name, right? But we should, because oftentimes it's not the first person who does something that is the one we remember or know. It's some other person for reasons that are beyond explanation. And so I'm just saying is that people change one by one. They don't change en masse. If they change en masse, like all of a sudden, it's more like fascism. It's scary, actually. It's not a good thing. The fact is that the environmental movement, as I discussed in Blessed Unrest, and the social justice movement, it is a response. And I compare it to the body's immune system. That is to say, it's humanity's immune response to disease. And this is like global disease. It's environmental disease. It is certainly social disease. And so the response, it always follows the pathology. It always follows the invasion. It follows. It doesn't lead. It's not simultaneous. And so when you look at what's happening to the world right now, there's a tremendous inertia in the, what I call the thermal, catabolic, industrial system, you know, that is so destructive. And so it takes time for people to realize it, to wake up, then to begin to act and to find those levers and tools and understandings that actually inform and make it more powerful. And so there's this lag time. This lag time is so painful. It is so painful to see the lag time. The lag
it's
time.
Not that dissimilar to what we're talking about with understanding racial issues and
absolutely
marriage equality, gay issues.
Absolutely.
There's this lag time in yeah the human mind where yeah it finally clicks.
We're slow. I'm slow. We're all slow.
But it's this willful ignorance that can be really frustrating.
Is it willful?
Sometimes when you see these, I forget what they're called, but the people who try to put as much exhaust into their cars as possible. I forget, you know, this like yeah I'm going to flout any kind of green
right
hippies and
right
just pollute the air. That's willfully ignorant. What is in the psyche of a person who tricks out their car to pollute more?
Tremendous fear and confusion. They're afraid. They're terribly confused. And they just don't know who they are. And so in a way, they're asking for attention because, you know, it's like that joke about the man who's really upset at the airline counter and saying, "Do you know who I am?" You know, and the woman says, "Does anybody know who this man is? Because he doesn't know." You know, they don't know who they are.
Well, that's a generous way of looking at it. Paul Hawken, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Alex.
Tune in next week for the second part of our discussion.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Maceo Parker, The Impressions, and Stevie Wonder. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.